Good morning. We begin this week's session with United States against Freeman. Counsel for the defense.
May it please the court. Good morning, Chief Judge Efron, honorable members of the court. I am Captain Vicki Ballou, and together with Lieutenant Colonel Mark Strickland, we represent the appellant in this case, Senior Airman John S. Freeman. I intend to argue the issues you've granted in order. The central issues in this case revolve around the statement appellant gave to OSI on 21 March 2002. In actuality, without this statement, we likely wouldn't even be here today. The first issue is whether the military judge erred in failing to suppress appellant's confession, whereas confession was not freely and voluntarily given. On 8 March 2002, appellant gave a six-page statement to OSI. Appellant agreed, and in that statement, he denied any involvement in the offense. Appellant agreed to go back to OSI in order to take a polygraph. On 21 March 2002, appellant arrived at OSI around 8 o'clock in the morning, and the interview began at 9 o'clock. He was interviewed by Agent Larson, who conducted the polygraph exam, actually two polygraph exams, and then Agent Bobo throughout the day. The interview session lasted until 18:10, about 6 o'clock. Over 9 hours, he was interviewed in with the OSI, and the military judge found that it was a custodial interrogation. The defense filed a motion to suppress the statements. The statements that appellant gave on 21 March 2002, stating that they were not voluntary as they were obtained through coercion. Military Rule of Evidence 304 provides that the involuntary statement or evidence derived from it may not be admitted against an accused. A statement is involuntary if it's obtained through the use of coercion, unlawful influence, or unlawful inducement. This case is similar to the case of United States versus Bubonics. In that case, there's a 23-year-old sailor who had been conditioned to respond with discipline to figures, basically because
Let's argue this case. What's clearly erroneous about the judge's findings of fact and his analysis? What's wrong with the analysis?
In his findings of fact, I would argue that where the military judge found that neither hunger nor thirst or fatigue was a significant factor in this decision, that was clearly erroneous. It took till 17:10, almost the entire interrogation, before they even offered the appellant any food.
So, what are we to make of the fact that the appellant spent almost 3 hours of the time period that you're talking about on breaks?
While he was on break, he was still being escorted by OSI, so he was not free to just roam around. And at that time, that could be viewed as their tactic to try to get him to confess to by having him be nervous and...
Does the record reflect that he requested food?
No, it does not. He did not request food.
So in the judge's analysis, you take issue with his conclusion that the court finds that the physical factors in the case were not particularly coercive.
Correct.
So perhaps you take issue with particularly.
Yes.
Is that your position?
Yes, Your Honor. It took until 1700 before they even offered him. They never did it at the appropriate times, which would have been around lunchtime or anything of that nature.
Okay, what do you make of the judge's statement, the agents used common interrogation tactics? What was uncommon about this interrogation?
What was uncommon about this interrogation is that the agents specifically, and the military judge did find that the agents told him lies, which that is not necessarily uncommon, but the fact that they told him that if he didn't confess that they were going to turn him over to the civilian authorities and that he would receive a harsher punishment from them.
Do the records say that he would receive a harsher punishment or he could get 5 years in jail? So by the military judge's findings of fact.
In the military judge's findings of fact, in the record it states that,
Sergeant Bogle's statement. Excuse me, Special Agent Bogle's statement.
Right, but if he didn't cooperate, the military judge's finding the fact that the interrogation was custodial, that Sergeant Bogle promised the appellant that if he cooperated, they could tell his commander about it and it might help. But if he didn't cooperate, the case will go downtown, and with a civilian victim, he could get 5 years in jail.
So, could get is different from would get, isn't it?
Correct, but Special Agent Bogle wasn't, when he was questioned, he couldn't remember exact details as to what he specifically stated.
So where are we with the military judge's findings on that? Are the military judge's findings clearly erroneous in that circumstance?
Well, Sergeant or Special Agent Bogle told them that their punishment is harsher than ours and that unless he cooperated, they were going to turn him over.
Where in the record is that stated?
On page 182 in the record. And his promise also about the civilian authorities, he in his testimony on page 631, too.
We're on 182. What are you pointing to on 182? Oh, there you go. On 183, you're pointing to, I would have probably said something similar to that, the fact that downtown's punishment is harsher than ours,
right,
or something similar to
that. I'm sorry. I apologize. It's page 180 where he's questioned, so you may have alluded to something along those lines if you don't work with us. And then Special Agent Bogle states, their punishments are harsher than ours, and it could be a lot worse. Yes, sir. So he told them that. He did state, I can't exactly remember my...
And is it a common police interrogation tactic if you're in the Southern District of New York, for example, for the Manhattan DA to threaten to turn you over to the U.S. attorneys and the other way around? You don't have to speak to that, but I mean, are you taking issue whether that is not a common interrogation tactic? Is the judge wrong about that?
It may be common to tell them that you're going to potentially turn them over.
Someone with concurrent jurisdiction.
Correct. But in this case, they took it beyond that and stated that the punishment was going to be harsher. And during the...
That it might be harsher. Was that an incorrect statement of fact?
Agent Bogle said that the punishment is harsher than ours on page 180. So that would be an incorrect statement of fact by the military judge because Agent Bogle specifically stated...
No, was it an incorrect statement of fact by the special agent?
That the punishment could be harsher?
Yeah.
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily.
But it is threatening appellant incarceration in order for him to cooperate.
And the military wouldn't, if convicted of these offenses in the military, he wouldn't have faced incarceration?
He would have faced incarceration, but it's improper to use that type of tactic in order to get him to confess.
So these are common interrogation tactics, but they're improper nonetheless. Is that what the judge got wrong?
I'm saying that there are parts of it that would be common. However, to the extent that they use them, the way that the OSI agents use them is not common, and that it's unusual for him to use that. In the United States versus Senate, the Navy Marine Corps Court of Criminal Appeals found that showing a booking order and telling the appellant that he had a choice either to make a statement or to go to jail. In that case, that they found that was not something, that threat was improper, and that they stated that his statement was involuntary. So looking at the totality of the circumstances, appellant's statements were involuntary. When you look at the totality, Agent Larson begins interrogating appellant after Special Agent Larson, who conducted the polygraph exams, after he's tried and attempted to basically told him that you failed the polygraph, we know you're lying, tries to get him to confess, appellant does not confess, and then Special Agent Larson and Special Agent Vogel. Special Agent Larson, who has a lot of experience, was not able to get the appellant to confess. And then Special Agent Vogel, who only had about two prior interrogations before this interrogation, once Special Agent Larson leaves, he continues to interrogate. And while he's interrogating, sitting about a foot away from the appellant, confronting him, that's when the appellant almost, I believe it's 8 hours into the interrogation, is when he finally starts to give any sort of confession.
The judge says, with respect to physical factors, in this case, the interview was a relatively lengthy one, albeit with many breaks. Do you have a view on how relatively lengthy this interrogation was? Is there a norm? Can you point to anything that would establish a norm?
Well, when you look at the case law, the majority of the cases show that the interrogations usually only last a couple of hours, where when it's found to be a voluntary confession. But when it starts to get lengthier and with other circumstances, then it tends to be found as an involuntary confession.
That's pretty mushy. Can you cite to a Supreme Court case or to a doctrinal regulation or manual that states that X number of hours is the proper duration of interrogation?
There is nothing that specifically states an X number of hours is a proper one. It technically could go on for days where it could be found to be a voluntary statement. However, the what needs to happen is to look at the totality of the circumstances and what actually is going on within the interrogation. United States versus Ellis sets out what circumstances should be looked
at. Is it fair to say, as I read your brief, you are not, your focus is on the threats to turn him over downtown and not on the duration itself? I understand the totality. I'm not trying to get you to disown the totality. I just want to make sure that I've properly ordered your factors.
Correct, Your Honor. The threat to turn him over to the civilian authorities because their punishment is harsher than ours, based on what Special Agent Vogel told the appellant, that is the number one circumstance and the heaviest circumstance within the case. That by itself technically could show and prove that his statement is involuntary. But when you look at the remaining circumstances, including the length of the questioning, the age of the appellant, the manner of the interrogation, the other threats used and the deception using the fingerprints, telling the appellant that there's fingerprint evidence and telling the appellant that there's a witness that saw
now,
him.
Blending issues one and two together, perhaps, is there anything about this appellant in the record that suggests that he was in any way particularly susceptible to a course of interrogation or an interrogation? Fill in your word there.
There's nothing on the record that would show that appellant was more susceptible than anyone, except for the age of the appellant, that he's 23 years old, he's a military member, that was faced with failing a polygraph twice, and the agent in front of him. But there's nothing specifically about his...
And the defense counsel specifically disavows that. Is that not correct in their motions for assistance?
Yes. But what the defense counsel basically states is for the second issue where they're requesting an expert, they state that, one, they're not going to focus on it within their request for the expert. However, they want the expert in order to help them determine whether the statement was involuntary. Granted, they had to make the motion to suppress the issue without the expert's help, but they also wanted to use the expert not just to help them formulate questions in order to question the agents to find out exactly what questions were asked and to see how the agents actually asked the questions, but also to not necessarily test the appellant on using any sort of psychological tests or anything like that, but to try to go through the interrogation to see if there was anything about him that would lead, that would be
What does the expert, let's get to the expert.
Yes, sir.
Preliminary question. At trial, they emphasized they just wanted him as a consultant, although they alluded to the possibility he might testify.
Yes, sir.
In your brief, you focuses on testimony, on the possibility that he's going to be a witness.
Yes, sir.
Where are we on this?
Well, the defense actually, in order to determine whether a consultant would be the witness, they needed to have the consultant in order to determine that. Even in United States versus Warner, it states that, citing Kreitzner, the best way to articulate and explain the need of an expert is by using just such an expert to describe their evidence analysis and development process. But experts were not readily employed by the government, charged fees for their service and detail. Defense counsel.
Well, now, wait a minute. That would seem to come in as testimony. He's got to lay a basis for his expertise.
Right.
All right. Well, then what are you saying?
Well, but in order to explain why they need the expert, they essentially need to talk to the expert.
Right. If the agents used common interrogation tactics and they're not arguing that they need an expert because of this person's personality traits, does that mean that in all cases where there's a confession following interrogation, an expert's required in order for counsel to assess whether to challenge the confession?
No, Your Honor.
Why is this case different?
This case is extremely different because there is no evidence whatsoever tying appellant to the incident in February. Nothing. There's no DNA evidence. There's no fingerprints. There was no blood found on him. There is absolutely nothing.
That's what counsel do. Counsel argues strength of evidence all the time.
Exactly. What does the expert add that any lawyer couldn't do?
What the expert would add is that lawyers are not necessarily trained or knowledgeable about what the OSI has been trained on exactly, how their training helps them with their interrogations, the techniques and tactics that they use.
I don't recall that this guy was presented as an expert in OSI-specific interrogation techniques.
Right, but they were requesting an expert that in the field of sociology who specialized in police interrogations.
I go back to the question. That is something lawyers are supposed to do. What does this guy add?
Well, because if
let me ask a hypothetical. Could the defense ask for an experienced civilian trial criminal defense lawyer as a consultant or expert witness in this case to do precisely what you say is needed?
If they meet the requirements of being trained in the field of sociology and the...
No, I didn't say that. I said an experience, you know, because what you set out is not sociology. What you set out is police interrogation techniques, which any experienced criminal defense lawyer has to know about or he's not going to have any business.
Right, but they have to have a general knowledge of it. In this case, it wasn't just solely about the police interrogation tactics. It's about how those interrogation tactics would lead to the false confession. And there's, as they referenced the article from O'Shea, that there is significant scientific evidence out there, and there is a specialty out there.
Okay, well, now, the only reason you're saying we needed it in this case and not in every case, Judge Baker's point, is that there wasn't any other evidence. Right?
That is one of
okay,
the main
there was,
reasons.
Fundamentally, it was based on what your position is based on the confession alone.
Correct.
Right. Okay. So, let me ask you another question. Suppose you put him on to testify as an expert witness. He can testify about the body of knowledge that we'll assume arguendo exists and how sociologists have looked at police interrogation and that sort of thing. MRE 704 says he can testify as the ultimate issue, at least in some, if it's embraced.
Yes.
When he starts getting into basically the credibility of the confession, does he not invade the province of the trier of fact? In other words, can you get anything case-specific out of him that doesn't completely invade the province of the trier of fact? How far does 704 go? Is there any judicial construction of 704 that tells us how far you can go in getting into the ultimate issue with an expert witness?
I agree that there would be a point where he would not be able to testify about whether it's what goes to the ultimate issue. However, his consultant, if they used him as a witness to testify, would have helped answer the member's question that was later on asked, where they asked whether these techniques were proper in what they...
Isn't that a legal question? What's he got to, how can he testify as to a question of law? Are these techniques proper? Isn't that a question of law?
Well, he could have testified as to what techniques they're actually trained on, which techniques that they could use, which techniques...
I see nothing he could testify on that a competent counsel couldn't find out for himself.
But the main issue in this case was whether they should have been granted an expert consultant. We haven't even gotten to the point where they need the witness, and they needed the expert consultant to help them ask OSI, because OSI, in their notes, never wrote down any of their questions that they asked the appellant. Never, it was not recorded. They had the opportunity to record it, and they needed this expert consultant to help them.
How's that different than any other interrogation? Is it standard practice? There's big battles going on. Not battles. There's a difference. There's a split among U.S. attorneys, for example, over whether interrogation should be taped or not. And the prevailing, the rule is that they don't have to tape them. Whether that's, I'm not supposed to provide testimony up here, but in the cases we see, it's not uncommon at all that there's all we have is handwritten notes of interrogations. So does that mean that whenever you don't have a complete transcript or video, you need an expert to tell you what might have been asked?
No, yes.
The key thing is, how's your case different?
The reason
how did the defense counsel alert the judge that this was distinct from common interrogation cases?
The reason why this case is different, it goes back to that there is just simply no other evidence, and the victim actually pointed out other individuals that she thought would have been committed the offense, that were present at her home when the night the offense was committed. There's nothing whatsoever except for the involuntary confession that appellant made after several hours of interrogation.
Counsel, doesn't that go to prejudice? That is, the absence of other evidence would go to prejudice if there were. Here, we have a question whether a confession is involuntary, and that's first for the military judge, but secondly for the members. And then if the defense wished to offer an expert for purposes of showing something counterintuitive, that is, why certain individuals would confess to crimes when they're in fact innocent and show something about police techniques, that would be their argument for the expert. So without deciding that, let's assume that they could get an expert to testify on that matter, and it would be admissible on the question before the members as to whether the confession was involuntary. What would a lawyer lack as a lawyer in assessing whether an expert would be needed in the particular case to testify? That is, why can't a lawyer read Offshoe's article, read the other literature, and determine whether they need to have an expert in that particular case, or at least discuss the possibility of an expert testifying?
if I understand your question correctly, the reason why they can't do it on their own in this case was because of the factors of the interrogation, what was missing from their knowledge of the interrogation, and the fact that even OSI testified that they weren't quite familiar about the Reed technique, and then one of the agents testified that they were taught the Reed technique, and things of what they were taught, the defense would need someone to help them in that area.
Thank you.
I see that my time is up.
You'll have an opportunity on rebuttal if you'd like.
Thank you.
Counsel for the government.
May it please the court, Your Honor. My name is Major Brendan Tukey, and along with Colonel Gerald R. Bruce, I represent the United States in this matter. Today, the court is called upon to address three relatively straightforward questions. Was appellant's confession a voluntary one? Did the military judge abuse his discretion in denying the expert consultant request from the defense? And did the military judge abuse his discretion in admitting evidence pursuant to MRE 404B? The answer to these questions, in light of the record and the applicable case law, are equally straightforward. The confession was indeed voluntary. The military judge did not abuse his discretion in denying the motion to compel an expert consultant for defense, nor did he abuse his discretion in admitting the evidence under MRE 404B. Furthermore, if he did err in admitting that evidence, that error was harmless. Concerning the first issue, the operative question before the court today is whether or not the confession was the product of an essentially free and unconstrained choice by the appellant in this case, Miriam Freeman. And answering that question, the court is to look at the totality of the circumstances with a specific focus on the characteristics of this appellant and on the circumstances of the interrogation. Looking at the characteristics of the appellant, we've got a 23-year-old senior airman with 3 years of service, at least average, if not above average, intelligence is reflected in the quality of his writing and his...
Okay, you've got a confession here which seems to be basically the whole government case. The confession, you know, one of the things about this incident is that the victim suffered very severe injuries to her hands, one of which necessitated the amputation of a joint.
Yes, sir.
The confession never discusses what happened in that, how she suffered this injury, nor does it ever account for the three people that she, the prosecutrix, supposedly said were involved.
Yes, sir.
Given these at least odd quirks about the confession, doesn't that perhaps suggest that the doesn't that perhaps impeach its reliability?
That may attack its reliability, Your Honor, but as the military judge found in his findings on this issue, there's a difference between voluntariness and reliability in the confession.
Okay, well, does it suggest further that he was unusually susceptible to police interrogation techniques?
I don't believe it does, Your Honor.
Why not?
Well, it can equally or even more strongly suggest a desire on his part to minimize his misconduct. It's not at all, it would not be at all unusual for a criminal actor to admit to the central act that he was involved in, an assault or a rape or any criminal act, but to describe
the technique, in other words.
Pardon me?
You're describing the Reed technique.
The Reed technique plays into that probably instinct, you one could say, in any person to minimize what they did by providing the person being questioned an opportunity to maybe couch what they did in the light that they think best reflects them. And in fact, I believe it was Agent Vogel who testified that the appellant expressed a concern about how what he did would reflect on him and a concern about the agent's opinion of him.
This case seems to have a total of all the circumstances in the interrogation. This has length, deception, threats. I'm not saying that concluding that's what it is, but there's a lot of circumstances here. And what can you tell us to give us confidence? First of all, who has the burden here?
At trial, the government had the burden by preponderance of the evidence to show that the confession was indeed a voluntary one.
How do we know these are common interrogation tactics? Or if the military judge got that right, because common would be deception, threats, 10 hours, blah, blah, blah.
Well, I think, Your Honor, that there's two responses to that. The first is that the record reflects testimony from Senior Special Agent Larson, who is a particularly experienced agent, as well as Detective Jarrett, the civilian investigator of all experience who witnessed the interview, as well as Special Agent Mann, the reserve OSI agent, who is also a civilian police officer in his civilian role, all of whom seem to agree that the kinds of things that they were doing were well within their experience in terms of interrogation techniques.
Can you point to a case of ours that we've upheld a interrogation confession context involving 10 or more hours?
I can't point to a specific case where it's larger than that, but I would note that in Ellis, I believe it was, this court talked about the focus on things that were not said or not done as much as on what was said and done. It specifically noted, for example, it's important to consider the absence of threats, physical abuse, questioning for days at a time, a lack of incommunicado detention. So that would certainly seem to indicate that merely 10 hours. I mean, the 10 hours, I would stress, Your Honor, is somewhat deceptive. I mean, the actual amount of time from when he starts at 0900 to when the interview process, to when he, at 1810, when he starts to write out his statement is about 9 hours, 2 hours and 47 minutes of that is given over to break times. So, and then the first half of it, about 5 hours, is the polygraph that Special Agent Larson describes as not confrontational, as more as a cooperative effort. So a portion of that interview day...
The polygraph was not confrontational?
I would not say...
People line up to take polygraphs as recreation?
Well, I think, it's very different from what we do recreationally and what we constitute confrontational.
I'm being troublesome, but... polygraphs where the issue is this is not a lifestyle polygraph. This is a polygraph that has only one thing at stake, which is did you or did you not do the crime? And that's not confrontational?
In this circumstances, I would say no. And Special Agent Larson made a point of saying that there was no, he was objective and working in a friendly manner with the appellant during the process of doing the testing, and the interview only turned into a confrontational interview where he said, okay, look, the evidence to me says you actually did this, at about the five-hour mark after the polygraphs. So I don't know that there's anything in the record that suggests that this was particularly confrontational. And frankly, even the confrontational portions of the interview were not overwhelmingly confrontational. Special Agent Bonal describes how they were on a first-name basis throughout the interview. The judge made in his findings that this was a friendly environment and that, in fact, the tactic really being used was to develop some kind of rapport. And that differs greatly from circumstances such as we find in Bonix, where a supervising agent stormed into the questioning room, the supervising agent being over 6 feet tall, over 200 pounds, screamed at the person being questioned and threatened them with then and there having them sent to the Virginia Beach jail. Now that is confrontation. In comparison to what we have here, where there's a completely different approach being taken by the agents, I don't think we have a circumstances where you can say that there's a threat that's overbearing his ability to voluntarily make a choice as to whether or not to continue to make a statement. Especially in circumstances like this where we find that the military judge, as he made his analysis, found that this appellant never complained about the process, never asked to stop the interview to leave, never asked for an attorney, or in any other way indicated he was being coerced or felt pressure. When, according to Detective Jarrett...
And when was he advised that he could request to stop the interview at any time?
He was advised specifically as that at least twice, once on the 8th of March, the first time when he experienced an OSI interview and read his rights, again on the 21st of March when he was given his rights at 9-11, I believe is what the interview log reflected, or 9-10 that morning. And then really, again, when Agent Bogle comes in and looks at him and says, you understand you're still under your rights advisement, correct?
Rights advisement, did that include, in while we're talking to you any time during this day, you can ask for a cheeseburger and get up and leave? Or when you say rights advisement, you mean Article 31?
I'm referring to Article 31.
And does Article 31 include things like, at any point during this interview, if you need a break, let us know?
Article 31, to my knowledge, does not include anything like that. But
so my question was, where in the record does it reflect that he was aware that he could ask for a break at any point?
I think given that that is a reliable inference from the interview log that shows that they offered him breaks and he was off of food, Detective Jarrett testified specifically in the record that agents went out and got him fast food from a restaurant called Popeyes, brought it back and offered it to him, and he declined. So it's clear that he was told on multiple occasions that he had what his rights were, and that to a certain extent he had the keys to the room. He could easily have said, I don't want to answer any more questions, I want a lawyer. He never even hinted at that. There's not anything in the record that reflects, for example, that he might have said, when is this going to end? Well, this has been going on for a long time. Can I get some relief? Nothing. It appears that he is cooperative and friendly throughout. And the agents all testified that essentially what he would do is give up some facts or information and then claim a lack of memory. And then they would go back over what he'd given up and he would provide them with some more, and it looked like that stutter step throughout the entirety of the process. So there's nothing there that would tell us, when we look at the details in particular, that his will was overblown.
Can the the OSI say to an individual, if you talk, we'll be sure to give you a military will give you a very light treatment. If you go downtown, you're going to get harsher treatment 5 years. Can they say that?
I think. I'm sorry.
And to what extent does that implicate any sense of immunity?
Well, Your Honor, I think to a certain extent that the question as you posed it would present much more of a problem than what we have here, because I think there's a much more conditional statements from the interviewers than the agents as they're interviewing. And what the judge found in his findings was essentially that, because keep in mind, this court hearing is going on a year and a half after the investigation, after the interview. So Agent Larson and Agent Bogle and others there did, and reflects in their interview on the record, have a fair amount of spotty memory about the exact details. But the judge, in hearing all that, concluded that essentially what the agent said was that if you don't tell the truth, the case will go downtown, and with the civilian victim, you could get 5 years.
And is that not at least a fairly strong implicit promise that you'll get less than 5 years in the military?
It certainly suggests, and I think that's what the agents were trying to imply, is
well,
that your cooperation would help us.
He got 5 years and a dishonorable discharge, forfeiture of all pay allowances, and reduction E1. Why shouldn't we send this back to the Court of Criminal Appeals to make sure that he gets the deal that was promised him during the investigation?
I think it would be a stretch to read that as an actual deal, especially as Agent Larson did say that when he talked to the appellant about the fact that he would be reporting to the appellant's commander as to his degree of cooperativeness, that I can't promise you what the outcome of that would be. But I can do that. So I don't know that the implication that you could get more, stated as a conditional, that you could get more downtown, could be seen as a promise that he would get less were he to cooperate with the military under those circumstances. And that discussion of what could happen.
So your view of the findings of fact the military judge was that, in effect, the OSI told the accused, the appellant in this case, but you could get 5 years in the military as well? In other words, what state of mind was the appellant left with after an understanding? Was he left with after the description of the relative sentencing possibilities as presented to him prior to his confession?
It's difficult to say that with certainty, given that the appellant elected not to testify and discuss that on the record, so we can't look to anything in the record that actually tells us that.
What would the reasonable understanding of any intelligent person be after this was posited to them by, told to them by the OSI? Is it that you would get at least 5 years in the military, or that you would get less than 5 years in the military?
I think the reasonable implication would be you had a better shot at getting less than five years in the military, not that you certainly would get less than 5 years in the military.
Well, didn't the military judge indicate that they also suggested to him that he'd get an Article 15 if he came clean? That's less than 5 years.
I don't believe the military, and I could be incorrect if I understand.
I'm having a hard time here finding
Your Honor, I believe
I think that that was one of the things that the appellant might have suggested that the government promised him, and that there was specific testimony by the agent that promise was not made, nor was that appropriate.
Good appellant's McCullough. Excuse me, I'm in the wrong place. Thank you. Just testing to see how well you know the record.
I was concerned that I might not know as well as I thought it would.
The discussion of the implication of swing authorities is worthwhile to make a comparison to two of the cases that appellant cites, to Bonics and to Senate. You know, in both of those cases, the appellant was confronted with the threat of immediate jail on the spot. He was told in Bonics, you're going to spend the night right now in the Virginia Beach jail. In Senate, the appellant was told, was actually shown a booking order, guess what, you're going to jail, impliedly right here on the spot. And that's not what happened here. What happened here is probably much closer to what happened in Ellis, where the law enforcement officer investigating the death of a child told the accused and the accused's wife, you know, we think there's enough evidence here to arrest both of you. And if that happens, well, your children, the other five children who weren't the subject of abuse, could be taken away from you by the government. And the appellant later on gave a statement implicating himself and only himself in the crime that was at hand. So when you look at that, the court basically said, well, essentially, that was a statement about some conditional thing that might happen in the future that, while it was negative, wasn't necessarily inaccurate. There wasn't a threat of immediate harm, and in the totality of the circumstances, we're not going to find that to be a threat in the sense that would force us to find this involuntary.
Assuming that we focus on the findings of the military judge with the phrase, you could get 5 years downtown. Can we tell from the record whether that particular statement was accurate or not? That is, not whether the military judge was erroneous, but assuming that he was correct, that that's what was said. Was the description of the potential confinement in civilian life accurate or not? Can we tell from this record?
I don't believe that's present in the record, whether or not that would actually be a reflection of Mexico law.
So you're taking as a whole, looking at all the factors of this accused and looking at all the factors under which this took place, that it was essentially friendly, that they were on a first-name basis, you had no good cop, bad cop routine, the judge found that the physical factors were not particularly coercive. It's clear that this was a voluntary confession on the part of the accused and that the judge made the correct ruling allowing it to be admitted. Now, turning to the second issue, unless there are any further questions on the first issue, the judge did not abuse his discretion in denying the motion from the appellant seeking an appointment of an expert consultant in the field of police interrogation tactics. And the obvious question here is whether or not the defense at trial demonstrated necessity, that being that they showed that the expert consultant would have been an assistance to the defense, and denial of that would have resulted in a fundamentally unfair trial. And testing for necessity, we typically look at why is the expert needed according to the defense, what exactly are they going to do for the defense, and is there a reason why the defense couldn't do that on their own. Addressing those in reverse order, it's clear that the defense was more than capable of doing this on their own. They mounted a pretty vigorous attack on the reliability of the confession that's very clearly reflected in the record. I mean, if you look at some of their cross-examinations, 40 pages of the cross-examination of Special Agent Bogle are devoted to the interview techniques and to what happened. 13 pages of the cross of Detective Jarrett, 4 pages of the cross of Agent Larson, 11 of Agent Mann. 10 out of the 30 pages in the record that are their closing argument are devoted to attacking that. It's even clear in the cross-examinations that they had mastered the intricacies of the reach technique, probably to a greater degree than some of the agents. On page 601 in the record, the defense counsel refers to information in the textbook on the read technique, which Agent Bogle is being interviewed clearly is not really familiar with. He says, well, I've actually been to the course, I haven't really actually read the book. So it's clear that what was involved in the read technique was something that not only could the defense counsels, in this case, educate themselves about, but they did so, mounting a vigorous attack on the circumstances of the confession.
Counsel, one thing that defense counsel cannot do at trial is testify. And if we were to draw a parallel here to the delayed rape complaint cases, where there have been holdings that expert testimony is permissible in those cases because delayed reporting is counterintuitive. If we would assume here, and without your conceding it, I understand, assume that similar testimony would be permissible in a confession case, that is, testimony by an expert to assist the members in understanding why a person would falsely confess under these circumstances. What was it that was available to the defense, in your view, that would permit them to decide whether or not to call an expert such that they did not need to have an expert consultant in making that decision?
I think their review of the articles, the review, obviously, of the textbook, their own experience as attorneys working in these areas, it's clear from the record that neither of these attorneys were phoning it in or in over their head on this case, could have allowed them to come to the conclusion that what we really need is here is not a confidential consultant to analyze our client or to analyze the agents here. What we need is an expert who can come in and more generally educate the members about something that we think is counterintuitive, although the judge didn't find it to be counterintuitive in this particular trial. And they could easily have come to that conclusion that that's what they really needed on their own and then requested an expert witness. And that's not what happened here. They implied that, yeah, down the road we might convert this person to a witness. What they asked for was a confidential consultant. And that's, they could not meet the requirement for showing that that's what they needed. And so it was denied to them, and it was not an abuse of discretion for the military judge to deny their motion. Had they asked specifically for an expert witness, we might be looking at a different case right now.
And to help me review the record here, is there anything in the record by the defense in terms of proffer showing that they attempted to consult with various experts for purposes of making any determinations in this case, and that experts refused to talk to them without paying a fee first?
There's nothing that I recall seeing to that effect, Your Honor. And certainly, one thing, you know, has kind of the court in the Andani case implied that there was nothing that would have stopped them from going back to the convening authority of a prior trial and say, we understand you've rejected our request to actually appoint this person to come work with us for X number of days. Would you consider a request for a much smaller amount of money and like unlimited representation to simply have this person prepare an affidavit that would describe in more detail what they would do and have them provide something that we can give to the court or help the court and or help us at least in coming to a better decision as to whether or not to help.
Is there anything in the military judge's ruling that would suggest that such a request would have been even favorably considered by a convening authority in light of the manner in which the military judge ruled on the initial motion?
We don't know how the convening authority would react to that. I think the military judge, in his discussion, which is pretty much at 248 to 252 in the record, where he's questioning the defense counsel on this, he's looking for why, what is it this guy is going to do for you? And all the defense is really coming up with is, well, he's going to help us interview the OSI agents who we are worried about be as forthcoming. You know, so I think had they been in a position to say to the judge, this was, we can provide you this information, they might have been better off, especially since this particular case was broken up into two hearings. They had a motions hearing on the 8th of the month, and it wasn't until the 28th of the month that the trial reconvened. So under those circumstances, Judge May well looked favorably on a more limited grant of some kind of assistance.
So you would read the record then as saying that although the military judge did not expressly leave the door open, the military judge's approach to the case did not close the door? Is that your view of it?
That would be my view, Your Honor. And certainly, even if he had said anything on the record, it's always our defense, obviously, to ask for a reconsideration under different circumstances or to ask for...
But for purposes of our analysis, isn't that a very different situation? That is, if the military judge has, in fact, closed the door, the defense does not have to do anything
That's
more
correct.
At that point.
The defense counsel indicated to the judge that they lacked the academic or practical experience to perform the necessary analysis. What in the military justice system, what resources does the defense have if they feel they lack the academic or practical experience other than to get a consultant?
Well, if they feel they lack the academic experience, obviously the first thing about it is the resources that they're provided, that they can do research and they can actually teach themselves and learn about the area. Absent of consultant in the military, they have an entire defense community of other defense attorneys that they can reach out to get assistance from in preparing motions and getting model cross-examinations. There's a lot of resources out there in the military.
For example, is it, they're free to call anyone and say you're now part of the attorney-client privilege, part of our team, or who are they limited to, and so on?
They can certainly, in this circumstances, reach up to the, well, we no longer have this position, but what at the time we referred to as the Chief Circuit Defense Counsel for the Central Circuit where they were located, and said, hey, sir, we have got this issue. Can you consult with us? Can you appoint another military defense counsel in the region who has particular expertise and experience with this, who can provide us with some assistance? So there are other places they can reach out to even get a confidential relationship, you know, another attorney appointed, or even to ask on a more collegial basis to ask other attorneys in the defense field if they've worked in that area generally without having to implicate any of the protected communications with their clients or to implicate the attorney-client privilege. So, Your Honor, in looking at the circumstances, it's clear that the judge did not abuse his discretion here. The defense clearly educated themselves and acquitted themselves well at trial on this particular subject area. Which leaves us with the third and final issue in this case, unless there are any further questions on the issue of the consultant, which was the admission of the 404B evidence. And here the judge ruled that essentially he would accept testimony or allow to be testimony on three specific instances between the accused at trial and the victim. One related to a confrontation that occurred in a bathroom in their mutual shared home at the time, one over an incident in which the appellant allegedly grabbed the purse of the victim, and another which was actually post the assault, in which there was a shouting match resulting from a disagreement over some French fries. Now, looking at this, you know, there's a three-step analysis in the 404B process. Can we find out that by parts of the evidence that what we're talking about actually happened? And here that's pretty easy. The accused 8th March statement recounts all of these, as well as the victim's own testimony in the stand. There's the 403 balancing test, which is to skip to the third prong. Is this going to be more inflaming to the members than it is going to be probative or helpful in resolving the case? And clearly that's not here, the case here. These three instances are not, you know, particularly egregious. They're not so provocative as to realistically stand a chance of overcoming the ability of the members to put them in the proper context. The real issue here obviously would be the second prong, which is the simple relevance test. Is there any fact of issue that would be made more probable by the admission of this evidence? And the military judge found that there was, that these instances could go to a reasonable fact finder to conclude that this showed a motive or a pattern or plan on the part of the appellant here to use physical force or the threat of physical force to exert control over the victim who he was in a domestic relationship with. That was a reasonable finding. It's based off the...
Counsel, are you arguing that the CCA's decision that this was error to admit those statements? Are you challenging that, or are you arguing whether or not their decision as to whether it was harmless or not was erroneous?
The United States disagrees with the finding by the Air Force Court that it was error to admit it.
Did you appeal that?
We did not appeal, but the question that the defense asked to be granted on was the issue as presented was, was whether the military judge erred in admitting evidence of uncharged misconduct. The appellant argued whether or not there was error in the brief of this court, and we argued back that we did not believe that there was error. So we don't think we're bound by the law of the case in this particular circumstances or precluded from challenging the ruling of the Air Force Court in that regard. But even if this court would agree with the Air Force Court that evidence shouldn't have been admitted, it's pretty clear that was harmless error, Your Honor. If you take a look at the evidence that was against the accused, there's the confession to the OSI. There are his confession to the inmate Ford in the county lockup, his second confession to the inmate Hassenrader, also in the county lockup, the physical evidence of his injured knuckles that was observed by Detective Jarrett, his inconsistent statements with OSI, which could be reasonably inferred to show he had a guilty conscience and a desire to cover up his misconduct. More than that, the evidence was not particularly central to the government's case here. This was not the centerpiece, and in fact, only one witness was asked about it in the opening statement. The government didn't reference any of the instances, and even in the closing statement, in a 15-page argument in the record, they make a single reference to these earlier instances, and the only incident referenced is the one that occurred in the bathroom. So it's pretty clear that these instances were not central to the government's case. They were not something that was driving the findings here. It just seems very unlikely that the panel members in the deliberations room were thinking, well, boy, we don't really believe the confession, but when he grabbed that purse, that proves it to us. So it just seems like it would be hard to point to any real harm or prejudice that was suffered by the accused in the admission of this 404B.
Well, now, you've got a confession here that says nothing about basically says nothing about physical violence. You've got a prosecutrix who obviously suffered a significant injury. And now you've got all this other stuff, uncharged misconduct, that you want to bring in to show what? That he was a violent guy?
I think the purpose of bringing it in was to show that in the context of his relationship with this victim, that he had a pattern of using force and so forth to exert control over her, to respond to her in a controlling manner. And
Ben, how can you say that that didn't affect, you know, how can you say that was harmless?
I think it's pretty clear on the record that it would have been harmless, not only in the absolute minimal reference to it made by trial counsel throughout it, but compared to the severity and the nature of the attack on the victim and compared to the fact that there was a confession where the accused describes hitting her about the back of the head 3, 4, 5 times. There's the fact that in the jailhouse, where he would apparently have no reason to say to inmate Jones, yeah, I did this, I attacked this victim, or to inmate Heisenrotter, yeah, I did this, I attacked the victim. In the context of not one, but three different confessions to different audiences, to then turn around and say that what may have pushed this case over from a not guilty to a guilty finding was purse grabbing or a confrontation in the bathroom in which the victim assaulted by slapping the accused, or a pushing instance relating to an argument over French fries, that's what did the day in for the accused in this case. So, Your Honor, taking a look at all the three issues raised by the appellant in this case, it's clear that the confession was, in fact, voluntary one, that the judge did not abuse his discretion in denying the defense motion to compel the expert consultant, nor did he abuse his discretion in admitting evidence under 404B. And even if the 404B evidence was admitted in error, that certainly was harmless error. Is there any questions from
him? Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
In regards to the issue that deals with the 404B evidence, the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals was correct when they found that the 404B evidence was inadmissible, the three incidents, because however, the Air Force Court was incorrect when they found that it was not harmless error. Basically, that evidence, the three incidents, did not in any way demonstrate proof of motive, intent, or a plan. It was not relevant to the facts of the case where whoever the attacker was, they flew into a rage against the victim. It is in no way that evidence was some fact that it proved some fact that it was in consequence, or made it more probable or less probable. Contrary to the Air Force Court's opinion, the admission of the inadmissible evidence was not harmless error. Similar to United States versus Cousins, where the testimony was that the witness saw the appellant use meth several times, even though the dispute in the case was whether someone had laced his drink with cocaine, the court found that evidence improperly portrayed appellant as a habitual drug user. In the instant case, the three incidents, the incident with the purse, the incident with the French fry incident, which happened after the actual offense in February, and the incident in the bathroom, all that was used to portray the appellant as an abuser. And there's no doubt that this influenced the members during their findings and sentencing, especially since they sentenced appellant to 5 years in this case, the exact punishment that the trial counsel requested. So the military judge did abuse his discretion in admitting the prior disputes, and this error was a substantial error and was not harmless. Now, in regards to the the denial of the forensically qualified expert, that severely impacted appellant's ability to present his defense. The linchpin of this case was the statements that appellant gave. And even the trial counsel in their argument stated that the 1168s, the statements, were the meat of the case. And by not allowing the defense to have the consultant to help them question the OSI agents about their tactics, and especially the inexperienced agent and how his tactics may have influenced the appellant in providing a false confession, that severely hampered the appellant and made the trial fundamentally unfair.
Well, you've got all this, the government saying had all this other stuff. You've got bruised knuckles. You've got two jailhouse confessions. How can you say that with respect to the confessions, the OSI alone, because that's all this guy would talk about, presumably, that it severely impacted it, if they had all this other evidence?
This case was a high-profile case, and the jailhouse confessions are mitigated by the fact that, one, he's in jail. There's confusion on the record as to whether he said this is what I was charged with or whether it was this is what I did. So those confessions really are not weighty in this case. The main, even trial counsel specifically stated, the main evidence in this case, clearly the linchpin in this case, was appellant's confession to the OSI agents on the 21st of March. And obviously the statements that he made to the inmates was after his confession. And when you go to the involuntary confession, clearly the totality of the circumstances, it was immediate, contrary to what the government has stated. It was immediate. Detective Jarrett was actually present during the interview. He was there watching the interview. He's the one who actually ate the, and Detective Jarrett was the civilian authority, civilian detective. He's the one who actually ate the food that they eventually brought for the appellant at 1750. So he was standing there basically ready to take over when they needed him to take over. So it was immediate threat to him. And the threats, he was escorted the whole time. It was a high-profile case, and the threats essentially were a threat to prosecute. And to do that, according to United States versus Jones and United States versus Barstow, it's improper. I see that my time is up. May I conclude?
You may briefly conclude.
The checks and balances along the way to what is supposed to be a fair trial failed appellant. He was subject to coercion, which led to an involuntary confession. He was denied the right to adequately defend himself from what was from that false confession through the help of an expert consultant, and he was portrayed through inadmissible evidence as an abuser. Appellant respectfully requests this court restores the fundamental fairness appellant is entitled to by setting aside the findings in this sentence. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And we thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. The case is now submitted. And although it has not been the practice of the court to recognize members of the public who are in attendance, we'll make an exception today to note that our former Chief Judge, Senior Judge Robinson O'Everett, is with us today. Welcome to the court. We'll stand in recess until 10 minutes after 10 o'clock.
The court stands in recess until 10:10.